Bill Reynolds has been a narrative journalism professor at TMU since 2002. Well, not for much longer. After more than two decades of shaping some of the country's best feature writers, Bill is retiring. He's made quite the mark, not just at TMU, but in Canadian journalism more broadly. He's been part of a quiet kind of innovation in Canadian journalism, helping young writers experiment with form, voice, and long-form storytelling.
Bill was fantastic. Everyone who took his class was really excited to make something cool happen on the page.
I remember on the first day of school, sitting in the reviews masthead room and being so nervous. And I remember Bill walking in and sitting down at the table, and he looked around at all of us and he said so nonchalantly, "Who wants to make a fucking magazine?"
We all were putting together The Otter for the first time, and I remember there was about maybe like six or seven of us all in the office kind of lost a little bit and like wanting to do this but not knowing how, and he was kind of at the helm and just like, this is what we're gonna do. And I guess that motivation in the moment is something that stayed with me.
When it came to pitching our story ideas, I was a complete mess. I was just a guy who only knew about video games in a program he felt he didn't belong in. And so we had a one-on-one in his office, and I never thought he'd be willing to hear me ramble about something he knew little to nothing about, but he did, and he was genuinely interested and told me to go for it.
I always realized he was cool from the stories he tells in class, but I didn't quite realize just how cool until I asked him on recommendations while I was in New York. And it got me to see this kick-ass jazz quartet.
He taught us that nonfiction can be creative, that it can illuminate the people, places, things, and ideas around us.
When I graduated, several of the students in my class got together and formed a magazine club, which Bill attended. And then from there, it went to going on runs with Bill, playing in bands with Bill, visiting Bill's class and talking to students. And most recently, I was a teaching assistant in his course and discovered just how hard it is to do what he does, even though he makes it look so easy. He's a talented journalist who knows how to tell a hell of a story. He's a very good educator who cares deeply about his students. And he's just a really, really cool dude.
He's also not the easiest person pinned down for an interview. But after a few emails and a bit of persistence, we finally got him. Bill, thanks for being here today on Pull Quotes.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Bill joined TMU's School of Journalism in 2002, after more than a decade in the magazine world. He was part of the founding team at iWeekly in Toronto, where he worked as an associate editor, managing editor, and eventually editor. Before that, he cut his teeth at Vox, a Calgary-based music and arts magazine. His freelance writing has appeared in The Walrus, Maisonneuve, This Magazine, Canadian Business, Swerve, The Globe and Mail, and The Hamilton Spectator. So the upcoming issue of the Review of Journalism is just about done. Publishing one issue can tire out a complete masthead, as I know a lot of us are. Since you have completed many more than that, how does it feel to finish your final one?
It hasn't really sunk in yet, I suppose. It probably won't sink in till a month or two from now. But we don't even have physical copies of the magazine yet. We haven't had our launch party. So there are things to do and things to celebrate. But yeah, it's starting to sink in a little bit because the world of the review is such that it kind of takes over your life, as Andrew, I think you well know by now. And it was only the other day that I kind of went, oh, right, we're done. Now what? I mean, I had more work to do. I have drafts to edit in another class, and I gotta, you know, we have work to do still here, but there comes a point when everything seems to come to a screeching halt and you temporarily don't really know what you're doing with yourself. It's like you've run off the mountaintop cliff and you're in the suspended in the air and you're kind of like, whoops. Nowhere to go but down now.
You began teaching 20 years ago. What first pulled you into the profession, and what were your expectations?
It's a strange story. I was the editor of iWeekly, a defunct weekly publication that started in 1991, and I think it lasted till 2011. And in February 2002, it was a Friday. They rowed me out. They put me in a punt and they rowed me out to the deep end of the water. And snapped on some golden bracelets and kicked me overboard. So about 2 days after that, I got a call from Lynn Cunningham, who was a professor of journalism here. And she said, I hear you have a master's degree. And I said, yeah, I do. Why? He said, well, you want a job? We need help. And I said, yeah, okay, I'm not doing anything. So I came into the review for February and March of 2002, and I helped a bunch of students who were having some level of difficulty finishing their features. I'm sure people on this current masthead can understand that. And so I helped them. There were about 5 or 6 features I worked on for about a month or 6 weeks. And then I think then it was over. Then there was a launch party in 2002, and I went back to my freelance writing career. So I was writing some articles for the Globe and such. Lynn phoned me again in July 2002 and said, you want a job? I said, why? And she said, well, David Hayes is leaving. He's not, and he was a professor, and he taught magazine feature writing. And I said, wow, why would he do that? And so I said, yeah, okay. And it turned out that my master's in philosophy was actually quite useful. So when I first got here, I was doing limited term faculty appointments for year 1, year 2, year 3. And then the job finally opened up and they decided they still liked me. And after they interviewed me and asked me to become a tenure track professor.
Yeah. So obviously when you started teaching, you had your master's of philosophy and you didn't teach at all at that point. What were your expectations going into it?
I had some inkling of what I was in for because I had a steady stream of interns at iWeekly, and I was teaching them, or I would supervise them minimally because some of the other senior editors would be working with them directly, whatever. But I had some inkling of what that was like. And I had also, I think I had come into Lynn's class once and been a guest teacher or whatever, guest lecturer. So I kind of knew what her environment was like a little bit. So I wasn't completely, you know, fish out of water. On the other hand, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing either. But, I, you know, David Hayes gave me all his notes for the course. He coached me a little bit. We went out for coffee and he gave me some advice and all that sort of stuff. And other people would come and help. And, you know, I put together the syllabi for the 2 courses I was teaching. And I worked my ass off to prepare for those classes because I had never done it before. So that was an interesting first year.
Yeah, a little bit about kind of your first experience as a teacher. You said your first day was the first time you raised your voice in the classroom. Some past students would say that you were pretty laid back, but then there's always mention of bully bill once something needs to get done in terms of the magazine. How do you straddle, you know, both sides of bill, as it were?
I think putting out a weekly publication at I really does train the mind a little bit because there's deadlines that have to be adhered to. And I think it's over time, I came to realize that I think when you first start teaching, you kind of probably, you're too invasive in terms of not letting students have enough input. Now I try to let students have a lot of input, but the thing is, at some point you got to step in if things aren't quite going right. You know, I'm a naturally chill person, but it's like, okay, now we got to go do this. This is what has to be done. We have to hurry up. You know, you can let people make their own way for a while, but then it's still a magazine. You still have to put it out. You still have to get things done on time. I never thought of myself as a bully exactly, but...
Yeah, so to expand on kind of that idea, how would you describe your teaching philosophy when it comes to shaping great feature writers? And has it ever changed over a year as you've gotten more used to teaching?
Yes, it has changed. I think in the beginning, I probably spent a lot of time throwing a lot of ideas out as just not being useful or they're not going to work out. You know, they're not going to have the scope of a feature, or something will be wrong, or, you know, the topic. What's an example of that? Students often want to write about stuff that's going on in their university, or, you know, and I'm like, no, Like, find a story that's outside the university where you have to talk to strangers, and you can't just rely on, you know, your hometown, your crew, your home crew. So that's one thing. But over the years, I sort of decided that what I would do is try to encourage students to really pursue their own ideas. I guess I made it simple to myself. Like, I need the student to come up with a story that I think is going to keep them interested for 3 months, because that's the length of the term. Even if a student wants to do it, there's no point in doing a story that's going to take 2 weeks. It's got to be something that's got a lot of depth, and it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of interviews and a lot of research, and something that's important, you know, relatively important as to what's going on in the here and now.
You've taught hundreds of feature writers over the past 2 decades. For those who remained in the industry and went on to shape it in their own way, what did they have in common as students?
I think sometimes we as profs, I think I've heard my colleagues say the same thing. Sometimes you just know, like you have a student in third year or even second year. I've never taught first year, so I don't know. But sometimes you see students and you just think, wow, this person has the juice, right? It's just there innately almost. And so some of the people who are in the industry, not all of them, but some of them, yep. You look at them now and you think, yeah, that was such a good feature that person wrote, and there he is out there, you know, amassing bylines in major magazines. You know, you just know sometimes that it's going to happen. Other people you don't, and you know, I'm surprised to find they've got a major job somewhere, and I'm going, hey, way to go, fantastic. I didn't see it in you, but that's cool. You know, way to go.
So on the flip side of the great features that you've read, what are some common mistakes that you've seen young feature writers make, and how do you approach fixing them?
How to know when is enough when writing about yourself or in your own experience, how much of your personal experience to bring in, how much to use the I. You know, you could probably do stories that don't have the I in it, and yet, you know, as a reader, you're quite aware of the presence of the writer in the story. So that's always a big issue. And nobody's against, well, not many people are really against bringing yourself into the story these days. It used to be taboo, but it's not necessarily the case now. There's so much personal journalism now that it's just how much to use it or how little. Structure. Writers have all kinds of problems with structure. You know, feature writing is kind of like written in sections. You know, that's the way it works. If you look at any magazine, it's written in sections. So what are those, why are those sections the way they are? Why are they structured the way they are? And why are they put in that order? I think that's always been difficult. And it's probably difficult for professional writers too. I mean, people are out there now, there's, you know, like I had a great example of that. I was writing a story for Maisonneuve. I sent it to the editor of Maisonneuve, Daniel Viola was the editor at the time. And he sent me this note about, you know, like with a lot of suggestions and fixes and things like that. And I got on the phone, he said, have you ever tried writing in sections? And I started killing myself laughing. I said, oh, you mean what I tell my students to do every year? He said, yeah. So even, you know, even someone such as me who should know better kind of did that first draft and kind of just went stream of consciousness or whatever the hell I did, and then got lost. And then after I got that piece of advice, I picked apart the whole, almost sentence by sentence, picked the whole thing apart and put all these pieces into little baskets, and then wrote it as a sectionalized bunch of baskets, and it all made sense. And then I was like, oh, I should have done that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another problem that is pretty common. Story topics, that's always difficult. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think I've said this a lot about how it's hard to find a story when you're first settled on a topic because you're so committed to speaking to a specific topic that it's hard to open your mind up to a kind of a narrative. So that's definitely something like,
yeah, finding the narrative, finding the tension in the story, finding, you know, the why now. And in feature writing, it's kind of like, why now? But now is, you know, 6 months from now, because that's when it's going to get published. So then there's that time lag, time sync problem, trying to make sure it's relevant to whenever it comes out for the reader. You know, trying to be the reader's eyes properly, that can be an issue. Another problem that's maybe not a problem, but one thing I notice is when people are seen writing scenes, often what they'll do is they'll start filtering. Instead of just letting the scene do the work, they'll start filtering through them. And so you're not really getting the scene. You're getting a filtered version of the scene through the writer. And sometimes, I think most of the time, it's better to just run the action and let the reader do some work. That's another thing that's really hard to learn. And that's kind of like less is more, right? If you got great material, just let it, like, just get out of the way and write it. You know, just let the material do the work. But it's hard. Like people want to get in there and, you know, tell the reader what that means or whatever. It's like, you know, the reader's not stupid. You can figure it out. So that's a hard lesson to learn. I mean, there are a few others.
In one of your features for The Walrus, called Geared Up, you say that riding your bike allows you time to ponder and later conclude that you are still getting a grip on riding your bike as a metaphor for life in general. 17 years after writing that piece and now leaving TMU, how does riding your bike remain a focal point for you?
I don't know why I'm so stubborn about riding a bike, Andrew. Really, I don't know why. I think it's good for ideas. I'm not doing it to be... I mean, I was always riding a bike, so... And I do appreciate the fact that my carbon footprint is smaller because I ride so much, but, you know, that's not really innately why I'm doing it. I just like to ride. I mean, it sort of makes me feel good.
So you were pretty covert in letting others know about your retirement. I know I was kind of like, is he retiring? I don't know, because I'm pretty sure some people on the masthead don't know yet. Is it a conscious choice to keep a low profile about, I guess, like your personal life, but also just retiring in general?
My wife said, what do you want to do for your 65th birthday? And anyway, we ended up going down to the Dominican Republic for a week on a beach. And we hadn't done that in about 18, 20 years since our daughter was, I don't know, 5. So we got there and there we were on chaise lounges looking at the Caribbean and all the sun dappled water and all that stuff. And I was thinking, oh yeah, today's my 65th birthday. Aren't you supposed to be retired? And I started thinking about it from that day on. I hadn't really thought about it at all, honestly. I just hadn't. And then the next year, school year came around and turned 66 in the fall. And I didn't think about it. I sort of thought, should I be thinking about it? Nah, this is no way. And then my 67th year came around, same thing. How am I feeling? Am I okay? And again, it was kind of like, too busy. Like, it's okay. No worries. And then this year, it started off that way, but then around just before reading week, it just started to gnaw at me. It's like, I just put these like simple arithmetic together. It's like 17 years as a journalist, 40, whatever the hell it is, 24 years as a prof. And it's like, that's 41. Maybe that's enough. You know, it's like, how long do I want to work here? You know, my wife said to me, a few years ago, she said, you'll be working until you're 85 years old. And I said, why would you say such a thing to me? And she said, well, because you don't like change. And I guess most people don't. But I didn't really agree with her, but it made me laugh.
So you've been a mentor and memorable prof to so many writers who've come out of TMU. When you think about your legacy, what do you hope it is? And is there any plans for the future?
So Luke Rinaldi, who's a feature writer, we met for coffee some time ago. I think he was coming into my class, my narrative class. So it was earlier this winter. And I told him, I said, you know what? This is the last term. And he was like, whoa, okay. And then I said, yeah, you know, 17 plus 24 equals 41. And he said, a whole generation of writers. He's the one who said that, you know? And I was like, oh, fuck. I never really thought about it that way, but yeah, I think it's great. I mean, there's so many good writers that I've had the privilege of teaching, and it's pretty gratifying to see them go out there and do well in the world. and they're all over the place. So that's, you know, that's just, it's just wonderful that they're still doing it, and they're still writing good stuff, and they're still, you know, they're important, and they're the next generation of people who are going to make a difference. So if I could, you know, to help them along a little bit along the way, that, yeah, that's pretty, feels pretty good. Sure. But beyond that, like the word legacy, I don't think about it in those terms.
Yeah. How do you feel about leaving it now? I guess you just said you're 67.
68, actually.
Do you feel like you are happy with the generation of writers right now, or you could have gotten another one to help the another year?
I was thinking of doing a couple more years because there's this program here, which is kind of like a phased in retirement program where you can choose to teach however much you want for 2 years. But after 2 years, you sign the on the dotted line, and after 2 years, you're gone permanently. You cannot come back. And I was thinking of doing that, but it just didn't really line up, because what wasn't clear from the beginning was if I did that and I came back next fall, winter, and the fall, winter after that, I wouldn't be able to take my sabbatical because I'd be gone. And the only way I could do it was to take the sabbatical, half sabbatical, and then start in the winter again. And I've done that once a couple of years ago. I came to the review in the winter, and it's a little chaotic because you've had no part whatsoever in the review, and you don't know a damn thing about any of the stories that are being produced. And all of a sudden you come in out of nowhere, and you have to get up to speed. So basically that year I had no holiday between December 18th and whenever school started up. So once I decided that maybe that's not for me, then it kind of came a little more clear that maybe this is it. But you didn't ask me what I'm going to do.
Chloe says you did. Chloe says, do you want to be asked about what are you going to do?
So my idea is to read more fiction. I have a half sabbatical, so I have to write a book chapter about crime and literary journalism. So I'm going to do that. And I'm going to use the rest of my time in my half sabbatical to write not one and not two, but three book proposals, because I have three book ideas. So I'm using that half sabbatical as a kind of a deadline to get it all done. And then I'll think, oh, I had a pretty useful half sabbatical, didn't I? I got all that done. And see if I can get anybody interested in those books, book proposals. And if anybody doesn't, I've also decided that I'm not going to sweat it if it doesn't happen. That's the immediate. The long term, I don't know. How about drumming for 2 hours a day? I'm going to do that regardless.
Well, thank you, Bill, for being on the show. Good luck with your future endeavors.
You're welcome.
This episode of Pulled Quotes was hosted by me, Andrew Roberts. It was produced by Chloe Kim, Maya Ivanchevic, and myself. If you enjoyed this episode, explore all of our podcasts in the podcast tab at reviewofjournalism.ca. We're also on Apple and Spotify, so check us out there too. I'm your host, Andrew. Thanks for listening.